Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why does your office look and function the way it does? For as much time as many of us spend in offices every day, we don't tend to spend much time thinking about how they were designed or whether they really serve to facilitate productivity or worker satisfaction. My guest wanted to understand how modern cubicle farms came to be the configuration of choice, and in his search, he went all the way back to the days of Charles Dickens and the long-suffering office drone Bob Cratchit. Nikhil Saval is editor of N+1 and author of the new book Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. Nikhil, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
So what got you thinking about the history and the design of office space?
Well, I guess like a lot of people, I had a job in an office, and this was my first job out of college. It was at a corporate publishing house, and I guess unlike a lot of people, I took my interest in the workplace and my own work and how it was laid out to an unhealthy obsession. I mean, it really just was one of these things where I was just curious. I was fascinated by my cubicle. I was fascinated by the way the kind of layout of the office reflected prestige and power, who, you know, why someone got a corner office or not. And it was actually in moving jobs when I had a chance to compare another workplace that was, in fact, much more poorly designed and a workplace that was, in fact, much more precarious, a publishing house that was in much more dire straits from time to time, that I started to connect sort of the economy and then the hierarchies of the office to design in my head and started to do some research.
We'll talk about this as we move on in the hour, but it's interesting that an unhealthy obsession with how offices work seems to have been a theme throughout history that is repeated in your book.
That's right. It was funny, I mean, to find out how many sort of visionaries or egomaniacs, depending on your point of view, look to the office as a place that could be improved, where somehow work could be better again or be better and actually reach some kind of utopia. I think people had a lot of utopian ideas about the kind of work that could be done in offices.
The first office workers were called clerks. Talk about the kinds of jobs they were hired to do.
So clerks were, I mean, you know, they're in a way there has always been clerical work as long as there's been paperwork. But in the mid-19th century, there was a tremendous rise in the number of young men who entered merchants, clerks, counting houses, merchants, counting houses, they were hired to copy, they were hired to do accounting, they were hired for bookkeeping. They often weren't necessarily at their desk. They would collect receipts, collect bills from various clients, and they were also acted as salesmen in the company store. And so this was a kind of work that actually most Americans at the time did not recognize as work. You know, the United States was largely agrarian; it was nascently industrial. And to see a lot of young men leave the farm or, you know, leave their urban homes and enter these dark, dank, sort of small counting houses where they didn't do any manual labor, they didn't produce anything, they just sort of reproduced things, they produced paper. This was very upsetting for a lot of observers about the sort of character of the Republic.
Yeah, people thought the spaces they worked in were kind of pathetic, and then they thought no real man, and at that point it was mostly men, no real man was working unless he was using his back and his hands.
That's right. I mean, there was a lot of people who regarded clerks, I mean, you know, a little bit in a silly way, a lot of these were journalists who themselves were doing similar kinds of work. So there was a little bit of projection going on, I think. But they referred to clerks as sort of, Vanity Fair referred to them as vain, mean, selfish, greedy, sensual and sly, talkative and cowardly. They pointed out that they were often sort of physically slight. Walt Whitman, the poet, just referred to them as being sort of narrow-chested, round-shouldered, you know. And they were pale. They weren't necessarily masculine. I mean, there was a fear that there was a generation of men that were being turned into sort of eunuchs. I mean, in their perspective. So it was that was also just upsetting to observers of this new workplace.
Yeah, it's interesting. People had this sense that office work was inherently unnatural in some way.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, in a way that it maybe has persisted to the present day, but the old idea was that, you know, this was not what people, there was no sense that business, even though people kind of lauded entrepreneurialism and the frontier spirit in the United States, the actual work needed to do that, the kind of accounting or administration or the incipient bureaucracy, that seemed that people were not even willing to commit to that. I mean, even like a man of the assembly line, like Henry Ford had no accounting department for years. You know, there was just there. And then to the present, you find expressions like in the film Office Space, the sense that human beings were not meant to sit in cubicles staring at computer screens. It's something about work, office work, that seems antithetical to what it is what our own capacities as humans, what we can do.
One thing that surprised me reading this book was that initially, at least, the one thing you could say about office work is that the pace was not relentless, as it would later become in the early part of the 20th century.
That's right. It was a lot more leisurely. I mean, there was the days were long, but they might even resemble some of the workplaces of today, or you know, a .com workplace where you spend a long time in a campus setting or whatever. But you're not doing the same activity all the time, and you're not necessarily staying in the same place. You may have to actually run around the city, and you receive visitors. Business was all done face-to-face, of course, for a while. Telegraphs were not in wide use. There were no phones, etc. And so you know, it was a much more, in a way, it was a very sociable atmosphere, and there was a kind of familial aspect to the early clerical office.
And they were, early clerks were encouraged to better themselves, and so they would hang around not only at the office, but they would find themselves going to, like, salons together in the evening and lectures and that sort of thing.
Yeah, there. You know, I mean, one of the longstanding questions about the office is whether office work is middle-class work or whether office workers are sort of part of the working class, depending on their income or what have you. And in the early days, at least, they tended to distinguish themselves by these sort of institutions, whether there was circulating libraries, they called it the Mercantile Library Association, there were lectures, there was a sense that office workers were reliant on themselves to rise. And it was not implausible. I mean, early office workers saw the offices were so small, and they saw there was no pyramid as such. They saw the partners of the firm as their future, and so they wanted to adopt kind of institutions that reflected this whole ethos of self-improvement, this ethos of rising to higher positions in business. So yeah, there was a definite sense in which they separated themselves. I mean, these were institutions that where manual workers were not necessarily welcome or common.
Talk a little bit more about that close physical proximity that they shared with their bosses. That, I suppose, allowed them to both relate to those bosses and also mirror whatever they saw them doing.
Yeah, I mean, well, these firms were so sort of small that there was a way in which, and again, all, as we mentioned earlier, all male. So there was a kind of unanimity or uniformity, at least, to the character of the office. And you know, if you were working at a clerical desk, if you were a bookkeeper, just spaces away from your boss, you had a sort of communication with them that was probably more informal, or you know, maybe in a way like a sort of 19th century father-son relationship. I mean, people, I think, you know, partners of firms maybe even thought that their clerks could marry their daughters. You know, I mean, there was that kind of attitude towards the workplace. So I think that proximity, the sense of space, the closed-in space at the office, really created a kind of bonhomie and a kind of not harmony exactly. I mean, but just a sense that these were meritocratic in contemporary parlance.
How did the terms white collar and blue collar come to symbolize what they still do today?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about white-collar work is that, and this was remarked upon at the time, is that white-collar worker, or rather office workers, wore the same clothes in the office that they tended to wear out. Whereas if you were a manual worker, you wore overalls or, you know, a company uniform or work clothes, basically, and then you changed when you went home. And so there was this business for, there was a need for business attire that would fulfill both the functions of looking good at the office, but also then you could just exit into society afterwards, go to the Mercantile Library lecture afterwards. And companies like Brooks Brothers, which were new at the time, would sell clothes with white collars on them for clerks, and sometimes they would even sell for cheaper. The cheaper option was a detachable white collar, so you would actually buy a white collar to put on whatever shirt, which was, you know, it was just a, and they were also disposable. You could, you know, so that was how it kind of came to be, although the actual term white collar to refer to white collar workers as a kind of different stratum of the workforce in particular was used in derision by the socialist writer Upton Sinclair, who pointed out that he in a book called The Brass Check, about journalism, he talked about white collar workers as being people who despised blue collar workers because they and considered themselves part of the capitalist class. That is, they consider themselves not workers, but nascent businessmen. And so that was how white collar, I mean, it came into being as a distinguishing marker, almost as a term of derision for them.
It's interesting that it still has a class significance, but it really is not, I mean, it's not loaded at all today.
No, it's not. And partly that's because white collar workers by mid-century had actually started to outnumber the blue-collar workers. This was foreseen early when in the 20th century, but it happened in the 1950s. The census recorded the leap, and I think it's just the kind of ubiquity of white-collar work that makes it hard to deride. I mean, you compare the tone of a book like the C. Wright Mills's great book White Collar from the 1950s. Basically the only comprehensive book about the subject. And Mills' tone towards white-collar workers is scathing, and it's a sort of tone that one finds hard to adopt today, even if one wants to condemn the whole situation. It's just that, it's hard to not to look outside white-collar work. I think that's why it's lost that connotation.
How did office work change as business functions became more specialized?
Well, you know, in the late 19th century, I think, especially after the Civil War, as business becomes big business, railroads create these sort of new markets or open new markets for businesses. And then, you know, a sort of financial crisis in the 1870s starts to force mergers and vertical integration. You have this massive, massive growth in the white-collar workforce because suddenly there is just simply more administrative, bureaucratic work to be done. And this puts a real dent in the sort of middle-class nature of the workforce because you then have, well, one, you have just different kinds of clerks. So like a single clerk, a clerk that would have done filing and receiving and shipping, you know, things like that in the early 19th century then was specialized because they had more to, this idea was that they had more to do and the division of labor was more efficient. And so you suddenly have like this, you know, it starts to feel to a lot of workers like a kind of office proletariat. There isn't a kind of assembly line of paperwork. And the images of this office are familiar to lots of people. You have just like desk after desk, row after row. Like the office really starts to resemble a kind of paperwork factory.
My guest is Nikhil Saval, editor of N+1 and author of the new book, Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can learn to navigate the ever-changing digital landscape with the Social Media and Digital Communication Bootcamp, June 4th through 6th at SMU in Plano. Details and registration at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with N+1 editor Nikhil Saval, author of the new book, Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, send email to think at kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So America's becoming more industrialized. Offices are beginning to resemble factory assembly lines. And then you have innovators looking to make not only factories more productive, but offices as well. Tell us about Frederick Speedy Taylor.
Frederick Taylor is one of the kind of most, maybe one of the most important figures in 20th century history, and certainly in the United States. There was a push in the early 20th century to make business more efficient. I think the more business grew and the more sort of unwieldy it was, the greater these bureaucracies were, the more there was this feeling that things needed to be systematized and needed to be made more efficient and more productive, certainly on the part of executives. And Taylor's particular emphasis was regarding the office shop floor. And he saw the factory. You know, he worked as a factory worker after failing his exams to get into Harvard, and he saw the factory as this locus of lackadaisical effort, of just lack of planning, just a complete it was a complete inefficient mess. I mean, this was his view. Of course, the workers what he saw was actually workers themselves kind of directing the process themselves. And Taylor believed what would be better would be to install a class of people who would study the most efficient, the speediest, the kind of least motions required to do factory work. And so he kind of became the greatest ideologist of management and management theory. Maybe he's the father of management theory in the 20th century. And he wanted to install this class of workers that would study the work process and then direct the workers. It would basically take the knowledge that the workers had of their own process and install it in a new group of people who were basically white-collar workers, managers.
So basically you have these managers standing over these rows of desks with stopwatches and, you know, watching like hawks. There are, like, in some cases, timed cameras even back then that were set up to make sure nobody was wasting a moment.
That's right. I mean, so what happened is Taylor's innovations were mainly directed at the factory, and then his acolytes, of which he had many, rationalized everything else, including the office. He had a sort of protege, William Leffingwell, who did everything in his power to rationalize office work. This meant, the stopwatch was the most famous thing, cameras, of course, to record motions. But then he would also play these games with workers and try to trick them into making them more efficient. So he would try to create competition between workers by asking one worker telling managers that they could ask workers to compete with each other for a faster method of envelope licking or vertical filing. I mean, and the idea was that workers without knowing it would just somehow induce themselves into being more efficient. And so, yeah, this was, which is all of which is in a way to say that these were not very popular methods, even though, I mean, because you had to trick workers into doing, and no one likes being watched with a stopwatch. So, but the idea was to get workers to kind of internalize management within themselves and compete with each other.
Well, it's worth noting about Taylor that he was very anti-union. This probably should surprise no one, but it goes back to this whole idea that you alluded to earlier, that offices he thought should be places where it was every man for himself, and whatever you could do to pit people against one another would keep them from organizing in the same way that their co-workers down on the factory floor were beginning to think about doing.
Yeah, and there was a sense that offices were naturally suited to a kind of ideal of individualism or meritocracy. So Taylor and his acolytes, I mean, they're a hatred of labor unions. I mean, in a way, it was their sort of campaign against them was maybe the most successful in office settings, because there was, you know, office workers were inculcated in this model of self-improvement, of partnership, of the sense that they were junior businessmen. And, you know, there were challenges to this. I think in the late, right after World War I, there's a real gain by manual workers in thanks to organizing in terms of wages and things like that. And so the collar line between white and blue collar starts to shrink, and white collar workers lose in prestige. And that actually leads to a spike in organizing. Suddenly office workers feel that meritocracy isn't good enough and that they need to organize to protect their interests. That falls away over the 20s, and then again it spikes in the in the wake of the Great Depression. There's any time there's sort of this challenge to meritocracy as such, any time there's a loss in wage earning or if there are layoffs, certainly in the early 20th century, you see a recourse towards unions. Though the office starts to resemble the blue collar workplaces more generally in this respect.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Brian in Dallas. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, very well, thank you.
I had a question, and it may be a little later in time than the author is interested in, but I was wondering what he thought about the effects of New Deal legislation, in particular the Wagner Act, National Labor Relations Act, 1935, which created distinction between employees eligible to be in a bargaining unit and those in management who were not, and the 1938 Fair Labor Standards Act, which introduced overtime but also introduced the concept of white-collar salaried exempt employees versus blue-collar salaried non-exempt employees.
Yeah, so this is the distinction that that the New Deal made in various types of workers, you know, between salaried and wage earning, or you know, farm workers and other kinds of blue collar workers, have a definite effect on the workplace, and they kind of last to today. I mean, if you think of the recent loss for the UAW in Chattanooga, there were salaried workers were actually exempt and able to campaign against the union. So it does lead to a very divided workplace. But it also is, you know, in a way, there is an issue there with labor unions themselves, that in whether this, and this is true of early European unions as well, is that there was not really a sense of how to make appeals to white-collar workers to organize. You have a lot of frank declarations of frustration over the inability of white-collar workers to organize. So in a way, the legislation reflects unions, the model of industrial unionism, which never really sought out the idea that salaried workers could be organized, which is not to say that they didn't. I mean, you actually have examples of this, publishing houses and things like that doing so in the 30s. But yeah, the legislation in a way reflects a kind of inability to see that these workplaces is organizable.
Office buildings are so ubiquitous in urban landscapes now that it's hard to imagine a time before they existed. But technologies that we take for granted, things like elevators, were a big deal in making it possible to put thousands of people into a single building to do office jobs.
Yeah, the technological changes from the early 20th century to about mid-century really transfigure our skylines and the landscape. I mean, up until the invention of the elevator in the late 19th century, people referred to the universal human disinclination to go above five flights of stairs. Mm-hmm. You were just not going to climb that many. And so the elevator permits, you know, this massive growth, as well as initially iron reinforced construction and then steel, which permits much larger, much taller buildings. Similarly, there are other things like the growth, like fluorescent lighting or air conditioning. I mean, these are things that permit much wider floor plates for buildings and lower energy costs. I mean, air conditioning actually increases energy costs, but the point being that you can have, say, a glass skyscraper, the glass curtain wall being another kind of innovation, and not worry excessively about the employees inside being burnt to a crisp because you have air conditioning. It's important to note that these are very American or North American innovations. In Europe, skyscrapers don't take off to this extent because the urban fabric is so much older and tighter, and the environmental regulations were higher, and there was just a thing that people were not inclined to build that high. And the other thing that kind of permits the growth of skyscrapers is speculation, the sense that you would just build a skyscraper on the presumption that tenants would occupy it. And so whereas owner-occupied buildings were much more the norm in places like Europe, which is why there are fewer such buildings.
What caused people to start thinking about air circulation and how much light was available to office workers doing their jobs?
Well, in a way, they never consistently thought of it. I mean, you think of it, it's the buildings that we think of as being really conducive to office work are rare, and they're some of the great buildings in the 20th century. So if you look at the Larkin Administration Building, built by Frank Lloyd Wright in 1904 to 1906, which had a rudimentary form of air conditioning. The notion there was that this was a company that cared about its workers. It adopted welfare-like policies towards them, amenities, sort of rec rooms, things like that, things that a YMCA in the building. And then if you look to later towards things like the Lever House on Park Avenue in New York City, that's another owner-built building that was focused on guaranteeing light to its employees. And it was just because the company wanted to be a sort of model corporate citizen. There was a sort of pressure on companies to do that. But then for every one of those, there were sort of 10 more knockoffs that were speculative and in which light and air circulation, things like that, were not so prominent. So it often depended on a company's desire to retain certain kinds of employees or offer itself as a kind of family. And this was a model that reached its peak in mid-century America and then started to decline after that.
How did the workplace change, Nikhil, when women began to apply for and be hired for office jobs?
I mean, the change is so profound as to be, in a way, difficult to measure, and it's just so, it's one of the great transformations in the United States. I think, you know, that women began to be hired in the mid-19th century, just during the Civil War, when there were men were out, you know, fighting. They had exchanged white collars for blue union uniforms. And there, you know, the pleasant surprise for the executives who ran these offices was that women were perfectly capable at their jobs and what's more, didn't have to be paid as much. And this is something that is still a source of struggle.
I love the quote you have from somebody who brags, like, yeah, we're hiring women. They work way better than the guys, and we only have to pay them half as much.
That's right. It's a kind of horrifying thing the notion is that, and the other thing is that I think people thought that women were not, there was another sort of line where they're not so apt to get up and rustle around. Mm. They're not so interested in rising up through the ranks. And it's not that they weren't interested, it's just that there was no plausible expectation that they would. So women were hired almost exclusively to staff the lower ranks of the office. They were in the stenography pool or typing pool. They did lightly menial work, or the kind of high prestige profession was the personal secretary, which was prestigious in the sense that you derive prestige from your boss, but you know, the work was often just very personal. It was psychological. You had to assuage your boss. You often picked up his dry cleaning, things like that, and often had to fend off sexual advances. So, I mean, one thing that the women's entry into the office did is it stratified the office. It made, you know, male workers tended to have the more middle class jobs, women to have the more working class or, you know, lightly mechanical jobs. But on the other hand, women, you know, it's not a totally a tale of woe. Women it was a source of real freedom. I think women, the office chose women, but women also chose the office. They were able to escape domestic labor, farm labor, things like that for some measure of independence. There was a lot of hand-wringing, of course, over the new sexual politics of the office with women in it. This, you know, which not just fears over women's virtue, as one might expect, but also fears on the part of men that the office was being feminized. And you have things like, there's a very fascinating film from the 1930s called Babyface with Barbara Stanwyck, where Barbara Stanwyck enters the office and she becomes this kind of, she's this kind of stereotypical gold digger figure who literally sleeps her way up the office hierarchy. And it's this financial company that ends up going bankrupt. And it's a kind of cautionary depression era tale of what, but it really puts all the blame on compromised morals in the office, that women have kind of sucked the masculine virtue out of the office. So there is a lot of fear over that. At the same time, the women are really making real strides and achieving certain measures of independence that they wouldn't otherwise have if they hadn't kind of gone into the workforce.
Did women take these white collar office jobs like hoping that this would all end with them finding a husband and being able to leave the workforce? Was that the assumption?
You know, I think there was certainly some of that. I think that the office was certainly portrayed to women as you know, not just a source of supplementing family income where they're earning a little money, but also a place to find a suitable husband. But there was also, you know, a sense, there's so much other sort of literature around the fact that women also seek advances, but they're not able to make them. The office has expectations that they won't advance. And so you have these kind of proto-feminist novels where women actually marry in the office, but then become executives. And, you know, something that wouldn't be realized for many years later. So I think there was a lot of hope that women, frustrated hope that women would be able to actually do more than simply get married, hit the marriage bar, and get out.
Nikhil Saval is my guest. He's editor of N+1 and author of the new book, Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. Up next, we'll talk about the history of the cubicle. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, communication, piano, and Portuguese. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with N+1 editor Nikhil Saval, author of the new book, Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Nikhil, it's really sort of tragically ironic that the man whose ideas ultimately led to what we all know today as the cubicle was this amazingly creative person who had all kinds of great ideas and really wanted to make the workplace wonderful.
That's right. It is sort of one of the great tragic ironies of the office. Robert Probst, the inventor you're speaking of, was. I think certainly never intended to be known as the father of the cubicle, and I think fought the designation at the end of his life, but it unfortunately is the case. Yeah, he was, you know, he came to be hired by the Herman Miller Company in the 50s to revolutionize the office. What the office he found was, he thought, you know, in a way it's we're familiar with the images from films like The Apartment or now the show Mad Men, this kind of workplace that was not really centered around work. It was centered around prestige or assigning people to desks or offices based on their status in the company, not whether they needed them to do their work or not. You know, the steno pool with its rows of desks that looked like a factory, or the kind of partitioned, glassed-in offices around the corridor where people drank and took naps or what have you. You know, this is the situation that Probst confronted when he entered the office, and he when he entered office design, that is, and he thought it was a wasteland. I mean, that was the term he used. He just thought it was the source of frustrated hopes, of just a daily defeats, just a complete mess that no one, you know, it might have been thought about or considered at one point. But by the time he got there, or by the time he got into the field, it was just a disaster for him. And so this is when he began his research into the studies that eventually led to the office cubicle.
So his idea was to allow workers some autonomy in choosing what they had around them and to set up their workspace based on the equipment or office furniture that they would need.
That's right. He, you know, Probst was one of the earliest people to research space planning as an epiphenomenon of just people's behavior, of their needs, both physical and sort of psychological. He was doing a lot of research into behavioral science, into anthropology. I mean, this, in a way, he was just a voracious intellect for a designer. And the thing he came up with eventually was this thing called Action Office 2. There was an earlier try called Action Office. And it was, you know, the emphasis is really there in the title. It was about movement, that he wanted. He had this three-walled, sort of disposable three-walled space, fabric-wrapped wood, obtusely angled. They were connected, that could be shaped to any kind of activity. It could be individualized. It was meant to just divide up a space as needed, and it was meant to be flexible based on workers' needs. And the idea was that it was your own. It was a kind of space of your own, while also kind of facilitating the kind of what things that we talk about all the time today, collaboration or an impromptu meeting or things like that. And this and the idea was that you would always be in motion. You know, you would rise to grab something from a raised shelf. You would kind of go to a sitting position. You were kind of moving between standing and sitting, and moving between space to space as well. So the notion that you were going to be kind of caged in and stuck at a desk was the furthest thing from his mind.
But copycats and other companies said, great, make it, put all the angles perpendicular and give us 1,000 exactly like that one.
Yeah, this was, over time, you know, Probst and others, you know, people who were also partisans of his original idea, witnessed the cubing of Action Office and the cubing of America. I mean, it what they sort of underestimated, and Probst admitted this towards the end of his life, was just the callousness of managers and executives in the United States. They had no interest in you know, making their workers happy. They were interested in cramming as many people in as little space as quickly as possible for as little cost as possible. And the Action Office and its sort of copies were unwitting accomplices to this vision.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go back to the phone now. We have Nancy on the line in Plano. Hi, Nancy.
Well, hi. Thank you for having your guest on. I'm really curious about this subject. Got a question and a comment. The question is, my mother-in-law went to work in the 30s, and right after school, she had a master's degree in biology, but she went to work as a secretary at the electric company for someone, and she always complained, you know, that women didn't get a break and all of that. But I'm not sure if that was typical for women that were educated. I realize the number of women that were educated was far fewer than it is today, but I wonder if she really was limited because of that, or maybe not enough ambitiousness on her own. Or, you know, was that just she was born at the wrong time?
Interesting question. What do you know about that, Nikhil? Was it common for women to have a great deal of education and yet go into positions that maybe realistically would have required maybe a high school diploma and a little bit of extra training?
Yeah, there was. I mean, there certainly was a kind of stratification of women's work based on levels of education and also just generally class background. You know, I think regardless, you were not you know, you were not going to rise into the executive ranks. That was just a very rare thing to happen if you were a woman, regardless of your level of education. But if you were educated, usually you would sort of be slotted into work that required more sort of, that was all about psychology and attitude and manners, so private secretarial work, things like that. And then women of lower middle class backgrounds or, you know, and lower levels of education often got slotted into this sort of more menial work of like steno pools and stuff. And you know, there were kind of intermediary forms of education to change that. One of them was just secretarial schools in general, like the Katie Gibbs schools, which a lot of people, maybe some listeners, have even gone through, where they were meant to make, you know, even they would sort of teach you the manners of a middle-class secretary in the office and make sure that you were educated enough to speak with your boss about, you know, Khrushchev, or, you know, or speak to your boss about the Cuban Missile Crisis or things like that. You would just, you know, that you were aware of the events of the day, but that you were, you know, you were also, you had this sort of demeanor of a middle class worker. So, no, I mean, education, you know, it for many years it just didn't guarantee rising through the workforce. It's important to point out that turned out to be true of men as well over time. There was an inflation of educational credentials required for certain kinds of jobs. That's still the case, that you often need a bachelor's to do work that does not necessarily correspond to your educational level.
How did tech companies in particular begin to get so invested in the idea of office campuses that were almost like college campuses, more spread out? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the campus idea has actually is sort of an old idea relatively in the history of the office. I mean, people probably know about things like Bell Labs in the 1950s, like the or less famous but also as important Connecticut General, these kind of like suburban campuses. And the idea was that they were close to nature. It was good if you did kind of concentrated, high-level, you know, scientific work for a company, that you could have access to nature, or, you know, they were contemplative, university-like. The tech campus reflects that, and, you know, also reflects just the university backgrounds of often the founders, although in an ironic way. I mean, a lot of them come, you know,
they dropped out.
Bill Gates, they're from Harvard or Stanford, and then they drop out, and then they build these campuses that resemble the places that they tried to desperately get out of. But I think the other idea is that the idea is that you're meant to. The general rhetoric is that you're more productive when you're on campus, when you're sort of in this hothouse setting. And so there's a lot of amenities usually at these places, as people, you know, things like not just like cafeterias and gyms and stuff, but bowling alleys and resistance pools. And I mean, you can get your oil changed, you can go to the doctor. And the idea is that it's supposed to recreate the kind of fervent, all hands on deck, all hours work of like the startups that these companies grew out of, and that, you know, you're supposed to run into people at your office. You might have the line is a serendipitous encounter where you run into someone you wouldn't otherwise see, and you innovate as a result. So the whole idea of the campus is that people, they sort of resemble universities in their layout, but also just in their ethos, that they're creative, and you're meant to just be there all the time. I think people, they think that that's better for the work that they're doing.
Does it work?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, you can see, certainly a lot of these companies are doing quite well. I mean, the most famous ones, but, when the way it works and doesn't work, I mean, it works to the extent that a lot of people seem to, I mean, not, you know, a number of them anyway, seem to like the amenities. They seem to want to get into these companies. On the other hand, it's not clear that they do anything that other companies might not be able to do without less, you know, with a little less emphasis on kind of keeping people there. I mean, other places, the other sort of trend is that you can work off campus. A lot of work is better done in a concentrated setting, in a private setting. Certainly the notion that you might just run into someone, or that it's easier to collaborate on campus. I mean, a lot of work does not require collaboration. A lot of it doesn't require constant interaction. Most of it requires privacy and concentration. And so to that extent, you know, the campus setting is not absolutely necessary for that kind of work. So it has some benefits, but it's not absolutely important.
So these days people talk a lot about flexibility. Many people who have what traditionally would have been office jobs don't actually have a permanent place to call their own in an office anywhere.
No, and this is a major change and something to watch in the workforce, just the rise of independent contractors, of freelancers, of temps. One expert I spoke to estimated the white-collar freelancing workforce is around 20 to 25%, though it might even be more. It's hard to know, very hard to measure. And, yeah, a lot of people have been thrown out of the permanent workforce, especially in the wake of the recession. Employers like to keep labor markets loose. They want to keep wages low. And one way to do that is to make it harder for workers to make demands. On the other hand, a lot of people, including myself, have sought out freelancing. And so there's a way in which it offers a certain brand of autonomy and control over your day, or at least over what you do and how you do it and where you do it. And that, I think, is also part of this trend. I mean, people, in a way, shirking offices that are, you know, often characterized by layoffs and insecurity, and, you know, why would they offer loyalty to a company that offers none in return? And, you know, a kind of epiphenomenon of this is the rise of things like co-working facilities, where you have these offices where workers who are mostly freelancers actually pay to have a desk in a company, which, you know, it should be shocking to the extent that why would you don't have to be in an office? Why do you go? But in a way, this might be the truth of what offices always were. They're sort of sociable. They're about culture. They're about escaping isolation. Not necessarily about work, actually. About, you know, workers who are freelancers don't often use these spaces every day. They'll use them to kind of get out of their home office or a cafe or something. So, yeah, it's a major shift in the landscape. The rise of freelancing.
I have to keep an eye on that as we move forward.
Yeah, yeah.
Nikhil Saval is editor of N+1 and author of the new book Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. Nikhil, it's been a really fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Katie Daniel. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.